you wanna fight. I'm not buying, no, I can't see the light. It makes no difference how you're waving the flag. It's all just a power dance. No, no, no. Enough to do here, why can't they see? It's time better spent, it's no mystery. No, no,
turning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program, Thomas Friedman talks about a carbon tax. A carbon tax on gas, oil, coal would balance our books, rebuild the country, bring America back, and save the climate and the planet. Thomas Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times and 3 times Pulitzer Prize winner. He talks to Tom Ashbrook.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman says the stakes are just getting higher on a real American rebound. Prepare the comeback, he says, or it's more than our economy at stake. It's our basic values in a world that could go in very different directions. You want a solution, says Friedman, a game changer? Bring on a carbon tax on oil, gas, coal. Balance the books, save the planet, change everything. This hour on Point, Tom Friedman and his Hail Mary, his silver bullet, the carbon tax. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you ready to pay a bit more for your carbon-based energy to save everything? Do we do big solutions anymore? Is this a big solution? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Friedman, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, author of the new expanded edition of his 1989 bestseller, From Beirut to Jerusalem. His big op-ed essay, How to Put America Back Together Again, got our attention. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Friedman, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks. Great to be with you. And I want to say I listened to you guys during the Boston Marathon crisis, and you're just great. So it's great to be with you.
Thank you. We're glad to be making our way through that, and I appreciate that. Listen, it seems like every time we speak with you, and it's maybe once a year or maybe not that often, but every time it seems like your level of alarm has risen again. And this piece, which was just, a few days ago in the Times, saying, look, you want American pluralism and tolerance to be the goal? You've got to be a strong country. And that fundamental idea of America as a strong country in this world is really in trouble. And we've got to do something. We'll get to your solution. But let's just start with the big picture. The stakes here, Tom, for an American comeback.
Well, Tom, last time we were on, it was to talk actually about the latest book, which I wrote with Michael Mandelbaum, That Used to Be Us, How America Lost Its Way and the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. And so this issue has been on my mind for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of simple argument of that book is that America, we make all mistakes in the world, and they're too long to catalog on any given show. But on balance, we believe, my co-author and I, that America provides a huge number of global public goods, whether it's, you know, keeping the sea lanes open in the Pacific or promoting world trade or the World Bank, AIDS, drugs in Africa. You can go down that list as well. And we also provide something else, and we think this is vitally important. That's an example of a pluralistic, modernizing democratic society where people from all over the world come together and build a thriving society. And we believe that if America goes weak, you're weak economically, Tom, your kids won't just grow up in a different America. They'll grow up in a fundamentally different world, a world ordered by Russia or by China or most likely by nobody at all. And I don't think that's a good thing. And really, my whole argument for, you know, why we need to strengthen our system is because it is a huge example, a powerful and important example of people of different cultures, faiths, ethnicities, all living together in a forward-leaning society. And that's really where I'm coming from.
You tied it right back to last week's bombings in Boston. You said, look, we don't fully understand what went on with these two young brothers, what may have gone on there yet. But you wrote, we need to redouble our efforts to make America stronger and healthier so it remains a vibrant counterexample to whatever bigoted ideology may have gripped these young men. What's happening to that example now? How does it relate to the economy? How does it relate to carbon-based fuel?
Well, basically, it really goes back to what we think the solution is for America right now. And we believe it is, call it a grand bargain, call it a small bargain, call it a broad understanding. We need to do three things, Tom, right now. First, we need to cut some things because we've made promises to the next generation we cannot possibly keep. Second, we need to raise taxes because we can't just cut things. If all you do is cut, look, I, as I said in that column, if I want to lose weight really quickly, I can cut off both thumbs. But that might make it a little hard for me to get my next job. That's what the sequester is, in effect. Mm. So we can't just cut. We have to tax. We need to raise more revenue because we also need to invest. We need to invest in the sources of our strength. So let's stop for a second. What are those? How do we get here? How do we become the world's most wealthy country, the place where more people want to come and live? It's because we had, I believe, the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world. That is, we had a public side that really enabled and unleashed enormous amount of private energy, talent, and capital. What was that public side? It was built on five pillars. First, we educated our people up to and beyond whatever the technology was. So when it was the cotton gin, universal primary education, when it was the factory, universal secondary education, and when it's the computer and the supercomputer, it's got to be universal post-secondary education. Second, we had the best infrastructure, roads, airports, telecom, bandwidth. Third, we had the most government-funded research that invested in the basic research of science and biology and chemistry, pushing out the boundaries of all of these fields where the best innovators could come along and pluck them off and turn them into new companies. We had the most, in the last 50 years, we had the best immigration policy that attracted the best minds and the most energetic people from all over the world to enrich our society and again, start so many new things. And lastly, we had the best rules. That is, we had the right rules and regulations regulations that incentivize risk-taking, because you need that, but prevented recklessness. And what we argue is that five-part formula, Tom, by the way, which goes back deep into our history. Think of Lincoln during the Civil War, what he did. Built the National Railroad, connecting the Atlantic to the Pacific. Started the National Academy of Science. Passed the Morrell Act that created all the land-grant universities. Yep. So we've been working on this formula for a long time, and our argument is in the last couple of decades, we've really let it slip.
Do you see evidence that that fraying in this country of that package, of that system and the success it created, evidence that that fraying is contributing to disorder in the world, Tom?
I think that would be a stretch, but I don't go there in that column or in our book, but I do believe that the opposite certainly is true. In other words, I can't prove what you said, but I do firmly believe that a strong America that is at its best and that is working on all five of those pillars is simply a great model and example to other countries that they will be inspired to follow.
You say,
and when we're not doing that, we leave the field open for a lot of other alternatives, or none at all.
Yeah, you're right. With so many societies around the world being torn apart, especially in the Middle East, it is vital that America survives and flourishes as a beacon of pluralism. I mean, that seems to suggest that people watch the signal at all times, and they may be watching it now. If it's strong, it's one thing. If it's not, it's another.
Yeah, people do watch us, for better and for worse, but they do, and we are an example for a lot of people. And at the end of the when democratic values triumphed in the Cold War, that had an effect all over the world. That did inspire people. And when we're drifting, it makes it easier for other people to drift. When we're playing small ball, then other people play small ball.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It is a nation whose people are sheep, whose shepherds mislead them off the deep end of history. It is a nation whose leaders are liars, whose bigots haunt the airwaves, preaching more violence. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and say there's no choice, and aims to rule the world through force and torture. Pity the nation that knows no language but its own, no culture but its own. Pity the nation whose breath is money and sleeps the sleep of the too well-fed. Pity the nation, oh, pity the people who allow their rights to erode, their freedoms washed away. My country, tears of thee, sweet land of liberty. First they came for the communists, and I said nothing because I could never be a part of that party. Then they came for the unions, and I said not a thing, 'cause I wasn't in a union, and what charges could they bring? Then they came for the Jews, but I did not speak up, because I was not a Jew. And besides, what could one man do? Then they came for me, I said, no, this cannot be. Well, I spoke up, but no one was left to speak for me. Yes, I spoke up, but no one was left to speak for me.
I didn't fight for the Romans, I fought for the Christians in Greece. When Christians turned into crusaders, I prayed for their tribes to decrease. And I didn't fight for the Spanish, French, Portuguese, or Dutch. When their ships sailed into the Indies, I said, look, but do not touch. And I didn't fight for the English when the colonies had to go. But I have to say, the very next day, I was fighting for Geronimo. And I don't like to kill, never have and never will. But I will fight for freedom, though the battle be uphill. And I don't fight for conquerors, even if they're presidents. They tried to buy me with dollars. They must think I've got no sense. And I don't keep my silence when my country bombs a town. 'Cause I don't fight for conquerors, I fight to bring them down. I didn't fight for the Ottomans or the Empire of the Tsar. When they asked me to kill in their colonies, I said, who do you think you are? And I didn't fight for the Nazis. No, I fought for the Jews. And when Israel asked me to conquer, you know I had to refuse. I didn't crown the Shah of Iran, Greek colonels or a butcher in Zaire. Didn't bank on Franco or apartheid or any who ruled by fear. And I don't like to kill, never have and never will. But I will fight for freedom, though the battle be uphill. And I don't fight for conquerors, even if they're presidents. They try to buy me with dollars, they must think I've got no sense. And I don't keep my silence when my country bombs a town. 'Cause I don't fight for conquerors, I fight to bring them down. I didn't overthrow Chile, slaughter peasants in El Salvador. When they went in with shock and awe, I knew exactly what it was for. I didn't send men to be tortured, leave their families living in dread. I didn't build prisons all over the world and pretend it was freedom I spread. Yes, they say they're spreading democracy, but they're soldiers in the CIA. Is that why they propped up Mr. Marcos, Suharto, Duvalier? In Vietnam and Iraq I protested while all of my presidents lied. When presidents stoop to conquer, I'm on the other side.
Okay, let's go to what you describe here as pretty big ball. Let's bring in the silver bullet. And I say that with a little tongue-in-cheek. I know you're not saying it really solves everything under the sun. But it's a long list of things. It's a profound list of things that you say a carbon tax could help us address. Give us the outline.
So, Tom, what I really believe is we've been at this budget debate for so long now, it feels like for at least 4 years, that we've almost forgot the plot. You know, like, what is it we're trying to do?
Yeah.
And so part of that column was to say, well, what we're trying to do is actually, you know, make the country strong again. Now, the budget debate seems to me to be totally deadlocked because basically we don't have enough cash on the table here. And so each side wants to take it out of the other. So Republicans say, well, just get it from cutting the social safety net that so many people depend on and more will in the future. And Democrats say, well, just keep taxing rich people or corporations. And neither side, because we have this sort of political stalemate, is going to be able to impose that on the other. And so what I'm looking for is an alternative source of revenue raised in the least painful way possible that would in effect produce a pile of cash that would allow both sides to get a lot of what they want. It would allow Republicans to say, okay, if you pass a carbon tax of $20 to $25 a ton, it would raise about $1.2 trillion. Depends on a lot of factors. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that later. Now, Republicans,
by the
way,
over the next decade, you're saying?
Over 10 years.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Now, you have to understand, the idea of a carbon tax in many ways has been a Republican idea or is certainly promoted by many Republican economists like Greg Mankiw at Harvard or Gary Becker at the University of Chicago, Becker, Nobel Prize winning economist, George Shultz, former Secretary of State out of Stanford. Now, what they want is a carbon tax that's revenue neutral. They say, let's raise that $1.2 trillion and then let's return it to people either in the form of a rebate, a check you get every week or every month, or every year, or let's use it it to offset your personal income tax, your payroll tax, and corporate taxes by the same amount. They're afraid to give that money to the government, okay?
They don't want a bigger government. They say, don't feed that beast anymore.
Don't feed that beast. But what they do say is, can we please stop taxing more of what we want, which is work and corporate investment, and let's start taxing more of what we don't want, which is carbon pollution in the atmosphere. And this has a long history and tradition. Now, what I say is, let's split the difference. Let's take half that money, if we could, and let's apply it to lowering everyone's, you know, rich, poor, or middle class, their personal income taxes and corporate taxes. And let's use part of the other half to invest in the sources of our strength, and another part to pay down the deficit and offset maybe what we have to do on Social Security and Medicare right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman about how to, he says, maybe save America. He says a carbon tax on gas, on oil, on coal might be the way to do it. The silver bullet that breaks open a bright new future. Big, big answer. Lots of resistance out there to it. But big problems on the table that he says it could address. You can join us this hour. Does this argument get through to you? Do you see Tom Friedman's point? Do you buy it? Could this be the magic bullet to balance our books, rebuild our infrastructure, refuel our economy, bring America back, and save the planet? Does this sound wrong to you? Too expensive? Too hard on the family van at the gas pump? On American business? Have you got a better idea? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Tom Friedman joins us today from Washington. Tom, you know, we've got people online here, some applauding and others saying, wait a minute, that's really going to bite. I mean, you say in your column, you're talking about more dimes and quarters that would come with this tax for every gallon of gasoline or hour of electricity. And people say, that's going to hurt. That's going to hurt a lot of people. What do you do about that?
Well, first of all, it's not free. And as I said in the column, it's not painless. But on the people who would be most harmed by it, the poor, people living below the poverty line, there are any number of ways to rebate the cost and to cushion them from the burden of the tax. And the economists have a panoply of suggestions on that. No one believes it's very hard to do.
You mean rebate the cost? So somehow what we take this tax, we carve out a piece of it and ship it back to people beneath a certain income level?
Right. You give them a rebate at the end of the year. There are any number of suggestions on that, but they're certainly, we can easily cushion the poorest of the poor on this.
Okay. And what about do we grow the government with this or do we keep it revenue neutral? Where do you come down on that?
So I'm very much on not growing the government or keeping it revenue neutral. I'm on using the money for really important investments in things not only that we need now, Tom, but have historically been the engines of our growth. Using it to build infrastructure, maybe wiring the country with high-speed bandwidth, something that we know would leverage enormous amount of innovation and commerce. Using it to fund NIH and all our great national laboratories and research that would we know have spun off so many great technologies that have been turned into differentiated companies. Those are the things that I would spend it on. I would also spend it, frankly, on Pell grants. More grants to make sure as many people in this country who want access to some form of post-secondary education can get it. I think that is just vital in the 21st century. That's what I would spend it on. And I don't see that as waste, fraud, and abuse.
Not everyone, of course, is going to see that as not growing government. You've got a large...
Well, all those systems exist right now, and there are ways to do it by incentivizing the private sector.
Right.
Up next, George W. Bush talks about 9/11. George W. Bush was the 43rd president of the United States from 2001 to 2009 and the 46th governor of Texas from 1995 to 2000.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger. These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat, but they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve. America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world, and no one will keep that light from shining. Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature, and we responded with the best of America, with the daring of our rescue workers, with the caring for strangers and neighbors who came to give blood and help in any way they could. Immediately following the first attack, I implemented our government's emergency response plans. Our military is powerful, and it's prepared. Our emergency teams are working in New York City and Washington, D.C. to help with local rescue efforts. Our first priority is to get help to those who have been injured and to take every precaution to protect our citizens at home and around the world from further attacks. The functions of our government continue without interruption. Federal agencies in Washington, which had to be evacuated today, are reopening for essential personnel tonight and will be open for business tomorrow. Our financial institutions remain strong, and the American economy will be open for business as well. The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them. I appreciate so very much the members of Congress who have joined me in strongly condemning these attacks. And on behalf of the American people, I thank the many world leaders who have called to offer their condolences and assistance. America and our friends and allies join with all those who want peace and security in the world, and we stand together to win the war against terrorism. Tonight, I ask for your prayers for all those who grieve, for the children whose worlds have been shattered, for all whose sense of safety and security has been threatened. And I pray they will be comforted by a power greater than any of us, spoken through the ages in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. This is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you, good night, and God bless America.
And now for something completely different.